Well, this is a very unsavoury story, isn't it? And I must admit, when I was preparing this series of sermons some months ago, and I read this story, I thought, I might just leave this one out. It doesn't seem to forward the story a lot. It seems to be a sort of side story almost. But as I've reread it in preparation for today, I've realised it's actually quite an important story in lots of different ways. If we take as our starting point what Paul says in 2 Timothy 3:16, that all scripture is God-breathed and is useful for teaching and rebuking and correcting and training in righteousness, then we have to believe that this passage is in the Bible for some good reason. It's not there just by mistake or some sort of historical oversight. The editors didn't just miss it when they might have preferred to sanitize the Bible. It's there for some reason or reasons, and it's worth us considering what God might want us to learn from this. So the question to keep in our mind then is, what is the main purpose of this passage? What is God trying to show us through such a gruesome passage? Let's look at it again, and I'd invite you to follow with me in the Bible, starting at page 25. At the end of chapter 33, verses 18 to 20, Jacob has crossed the river and finally pitched his tent in the land of Canaan, the land that God has promised him. And the land is already inhabited by people variously called Canaanites or Hivites or Perizzites. And these tribes are different to Jacob and his tribe, his growing tribe. They have their own gods, their own morals, and they're concerned about their own welfare. And it's in the midst of this pagan people that at the end of chapter 33, Jacob erects an altar and worships for the first time in his life the God who is called the God of Israel. Remember, he'd only received that name in chapter 32. The story of chapter 34 begins then with Dinah, the daughter of Jacob's first wife, Leah. You'll remember that Leah was the wife that Jacob was deceived into marrying by his crafty uncle Laban. Leah also has six sons with Jacob. They are Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. And after them comes Dinah. So she's the only sister in a house full of boys. And she's probably about 15 years of age when this story takes place. In chapter 34, verse 1, it says that she goes out to visit the women of the land. Now, that refers to the Canaanite women. It's hard to know exactly what she's doing in going out to visit the Canaanite women, but she is at least risking her own safety by moving outside the protection of her own family. Hamer is the local Canaanite ruler, and Shechem is his most honoured son, verse 19. Shechem, in other words, is like a local prince, someone with some influence, presumably some money, definitely with power and prestige. This description of what he does in verse 2 is very brief, but it's clear. He takes Dinah and he violates her, verse 2. The original language makes it quite clear that this is rape, and it has in its language a suggestion of violence. The writer doesn't dwell on this, but moves quickly on to what happens next. Having taken Dinah violently, Shechem now falls in love with her and wants her as a wife. The violence of the crime is seemingly softened by his language of love. Look at verse 3. It says, his heart was drawn to her. He loved her and he spoke tenderly to her. We're told later he is delighted with her. The mixture of violence and love, I don't think, is meant to be exonerated. From the beginning of Genesis, we're told that the model relationship of men and women is Adam and Eve in the garden, naked before each other and before God, and without fear. That is the model that God has placed in his people's history. And this is a long way from how Shechem has treated Dinah. The writer is here hinting, and only hinting, I think, that God's people are to treat one another differently to the other nations. This is one reason they're not to intermarry. They are to be different, much like Christians are called to be different, men and women treating one another with respect, with love, and with mutual submission. We read that in Paul's epistles. Dinah, as a person, sort of disappears from the story. We never hear her voice, and interestingly, we never hear her mother's voice or Rachel's voice either. And it appears that she remains in Shechem's home during the subsequent events. The story is now told largely through the eyes of men. As a man, it's hard for me to fully appreciate this, but many women will know this experience of losing their voice when some sexual crime has been committed against them. The story gives an ancient picture of how a woman's future is tied to men, to her father, her brothers, and her male neighbours. It is the men who have the power to decide the woman's future. Even today, and even inside the church, women find it difficult to have their voice heard when they are violated. So it is the men who talk and act throughout the rest of the chapter. So let us look at verses 4 to 31. The main talkers and actors are Hamer, his son Shechem, and Dinah's brothers. The character who also we don't hear much from is Dinah's father, Jacob. Verse 5, he remains quiet until his sons come home, and he won't actually say anything till near the end of the chapter. Now, is his quietness, his silence, is this an indication that he has a lower concern for Dinah because she's one of Leah's children, not one of the beloved Rachel's children? Maybe. One commentator actually says this is Jacob being very wise, taking some time to think and reflect before saying anything. Maybe. It's hard to know exactly what Jacob isn't doing and how to understand his quietness here, but when we read the rest of the chapter, it's difficult to see him acting in a way that provides the sort of leadership a father would provide for a daughter who's been violated. The moral responsibility for sorting out the situation devolves to his sons. Verse 7, they are furious at what has happened to their sister. They see this as a disgraceful act that Shechem has committed, something that shouldn't be done, and I don't think any reader would disagree with them. Interestingly, note in verse 7 that in lying with Jacob's daughter, Shechem has done a disgraceful thing in Israel. The nation of Israel doesn't yet exist, but the way the writer has written this is to show that this is a crime against the community, against Israel. This is a disgraceful thing that shouldn't happen in this community. Here is a hint at one of the key meanings of the text, I think. One of the things we're to notice is the growing sense in God's people of their separate identity, that they are to be different. And this story throws up an enormous question for them. How are they to relate to the other nations? And you can make that question very modern and say, how do Christians relate in a world where sexual morality is very different to what the Bible asks us to be like? What should they do when crimes like this are committed against someone in their community? Well, Hamer has a suggestion of what they should do. And his suggestion is, let's have peace. Let's not make trouble over this incident. Let Shechem marry Dinah. Not only that, let's all intermarry. You have our daughters, we'll have your daughters. Verse 9 and 10, you then can settle here in peace. Let's not let this little incident get between us as people. You settle down, you can have land, you can have prosperity. You can grow your business and acquire property. Hamer doesn't seem at all worried about the crime that has occurred. He's not concerned about justice or reparation. He is concerned to make the best out of a tricky situation, and his method is to negotiate and bargain. And he appeals to the other men's self-interest, to their potential greed. This could turn out for their mutual benefit. But as you read it, it all sounds rather tacky, doesn't it? And Dinah just seems to be a piece of merchandise that is part of the trade. The temptation for Jacob and his sons is that if they accept, they will gain peace from what for them is also a dangerous situation, but what they will lose is the distinction of being God's people. So the temptation here puts at risk the very identity. If you imagine generations after all this intermarrying goes on and you try to find out, well, who are God's people, they'd all have just merged into the local tribes and you wouldn't be able to say who God's people were anymore. They would have lost their identity. The offer from Hamor of land is ironic in the story of Genesis because this is the land that God has promised his people. It's not Hamor's land to be selling and negotiating with. And the question is, will Jacob and his sons accept the offer that is being put to them? And it's another example of how the promises of God are put at risk through Genesis regularly. Shechem is desperate to get Dinah as his wife, and he offers in verses 11 and 12 to pay any price. There are ancient laws which say when a man rapes a woman, he is to marry her and to pay an increased bridal price as a form of reparation. And that's what Shechem is offering to do. The brother's anger, though, has not been mollified by all this talk about intermarriage and land and money. They appear to accept the offer on the surface, but verse 7 says they are filled with fury and filled with grief. Verse 13 is the turning point, if you just look at that. Because their sister Dinah had been defiled, Jacob's sons replied deceitfully as they spoke to Shechem and his father Hamor. The word deceitfully warns us that the moral framework of the story is changing. Up to this point, Jacob's family were the victims. Now they take the initiative. But we're warned by the writer through the use of that well-known Jacob word, deceit, that we're not to condone what is about to happen. They say they will only accept Hamor's offer if all the men are circumcised. Now remember, circumcision was given to Abraham as a sign of God's covenant with his people. It's a sign of a special relationship between God and his people. It's not a tool for negotiation. What the boys are about to do is sacrilege. They are taking something holy and using it for unholy purposes. That's the nature of their deceit. Shechem and Hamor don't know that, and they go back to their town and they report to all their men about these negotiations. But the story they tell their men is different to the story that they have negotiated with Jacob's sons. In verse 23, they tell the men of the town that Jacob's family will settle in the area and we will slowly take control of all their animals and their property if you just get circumcised. So Hamor and Shechem appeal now to their own men's self-interest and greed. Here we see the true heart of Hamor and his son, mercenary and opportunistic, with not a thought for justice or for truth even. Hamor is an excellent wheeler-dealer, but he's certainly not someone to be trusted. Perhaps it's no surprise that he has a son who is used to getting what he wants. Once the men have been circumcised and are in pain, Dinah's brothers Simeon and Levi come and massacre them, verse 25. They kill Hamor and Shechem, and they take Dinah back, verse 26, who throughout this negotiation has been in Shechem's house. They and maybe some of their other brothers then loot the city, taking as plunder the women, the children, the animals, and all the wealth of the Shechemites. It's a bloodthirsty and merciless revenge. Simeon and Levi were no doubt assisted by their servants and, as I said, maybe some of the other brothers, but they are seen as the leaders of this revenge. This is the outworking of the fury that they felt over the defilement of their sister. Some of you this morning might feel that they've acted quite correctly. Jacob's response at the end is concern for the family's safety. Now that his sons have committed such a crime, what if the local tribes band together and attack us? You know, what if this revenge just escalates even further? We'll be wiped out. And again, we see that the promises of God are at risk. It's not surprising at the start of the next chapter, Jacob says, "Let's go," and they move out of that area. The story ends, though, with Simeon and Levi's moral outrage expressed to their father. Should he have treated our sister as a prostitute? The he presumably being Shechem. And there the story ends. How do we read this story? How do we understand the characters? And particularly when in crimes like this you look for people to blame. Who is to blame for a situation that is so horrible? Dinah? Herself? Perhaps by moving around the local women, she's taken too great a risk. There are places that women just shouldn't go and risks that they shouldn't take. We hear many stories of young women today taking risks and getting into trouble, and it's hard sometimes not to think, maybe they brought a little bit of that on themselves. But the story doesn't let us put too much blame on Dinah. Shechem, undoubtedly guilty of rape. Does his protestations of love make him sound any more attractive, any less guilty? Hamor, the father, the commercially minded father who tries to smooth things over, first by lying to Jacob and then to his own people. He and his son, instead of increasing his town's wealth, actually bring it to ruin by their combined immorality. Jacob, strangely silent at first and not able to control his sons, not seemingly aware of what's going on. Has he become a leader who withdraws out of tricky moral situations because it's all too hard? Simeon and Levi. Perhaps they have justifiable anger, but are they seen as heroes in this story? Not only are we told clearly that they act deceitfully, but their vengeance is on a scale and barbarity beyond the original crime. Their desire for justice is quite correct, but their means of achieving justice is ruthless and excessive. The Old Testament law will later limit this type of response to an eye for an eye, to stop this type of escalating vengeance. At the end of chapter 40, or at the end of Genesis in chapter 49, Jacob, as an old man, is about to bless each of his sons. He doesn't bless Simeon and Levi. He actually curses them. He calls them men of violence. And he says, "Cursed be their anger so fierce and their fury so cruel. I will scatter them in Jacob and disperse them in Israel." In other words, his curse on Levi and Simeon is they in fact won't have any land. And the descendants of these two sons are indeed scattered. The Levites are scattered through the other tribes, and the Simeonites are largely absorbed into the territory of Judah. So Genesis doesn't allow us to see Simeon and Levi as heroes. I think the way to understand this story is not to look at it in isolation, but to see it as part of the story of Genesis. God is creating a people for himself, and he's made amazing promises to them that they will have a land, that they'll be a big family, and through living as this family, this community in this land, they will be a blessing to all the other nations. Those are the promises he made to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And we watch as Genesis unfolds how these promises are put at risk time and time again, and we wonder whether or not God will achieve his promises. One problem that we encounter in chapter 34 is that there are people already living in this land. The land that God promises is not an empty land. It's a land that is peopled. But it has people in there who live by different morals and have their own gods. They don't know what it's like to live as God's people. How could they? God hasn't shown them. But the real problem in the story is not, I don't think, with the Hivites, the Perizzites, and the Canaanites. The real problem in the story is God's people. We see yet again that God's people struggle to be God's people. When they are provoked, they are bloodthirsty beyond imagination. We are reminded that these people are cruel and deceitful. They are truly sons of Adam. And although God himself doesn't appear in Genesis 34, we are reminded, I think, as we stand back from the story, that God is extraordinary. He is so patient in forming his people, in creating the people that he's made these promises to, that he continues to stay in relationship with people that he knows are capable of this type of violence. And although we don't see a full outworking of this story in Genesis, we do see it in the Bible. We see that God knows what your heart and my heart is like, that inside all of our hearts is the potential for hurt, for cruelty, for deception, for violence, for all sorts of ungodly activity. And into this world, God sends his son, Jesus, to say, there is a better way. We do not have to let everything self-combust. I will show you a better way. And into this world and into our human hearts, he sends his Holy Spirit to change and refine and sanctify, and for those who are abused and hurt, to offer healing and consolation. God is extraordinarily patient and kind in doing that. We may be correct in feeling righteous anger at the harm and abuse that is committed today. We see it often perpetrated by men against women. We read about horrific stories of violence, often associated with war, when rape and abuse happens on mass scales. Sadly, violence and abuse also occur and are committed against children and men. In our pursuit of justice, we are not allowed to be like Simeon and Levi. We are to pursue justice in a way that does honour to God and his covenant with us. Although we might feel righteous anger at what we see happening, our means of achieving justice must also bring honour to God. Otherwise, we are no better than those who caused the crimes, I believe. We are to seek justice and oppose evil. Yes, absolutely. We can't sit quietly like Jacob, but we're to do it in a way that brings honour to God. I finish today amazed that God would have anything to do with us. Absolutely amazed.